Hey, welcome back to Leave the Swamp, the Texit podcast. Thanks for tuning in and joining the cause for a peaceful and friendly separation. That's what we advocate here, because you and I think, both know that it's badly needed, long past the time. And, I mean, along those lines, you know, thinking about how that whole transition might work, I've been reading through this book called Texit by Daniel Miller. And what I want to do in this episode is continuing to read through the book and giving my commentary where commentary is needed. I guess this is the fourth installment of this series. So we're starting here on chapter 2, titled Understanding the American Union. And it starts with a quote. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason. Thomas Paine. Well, I love that quote. It's so true. We've been with this situation for so long, this is me talking, that we just tend to think that it's like part of the cosmic fabric of the universe, that we as Texans and Texas has to be part of the United States and be under the thumb, under the oppressive, tyrannical thumb of Mordor, D.C. And that just isn't the case. So I'll continue in the book here. I'm going to describe a political entity to you, but I'm not going to tell you its name. Let's see if you can get it. This is a union of many states who enjoy free trade and travel among one another. They send elected representatives to a specific city who make laws, rules, and regulations for all of them. They have a judiciary system and a diplomatic relations with other countries around the world. They have a common passport, a common defense, and a common currency. Were you able to guess it? If you said the European Union, you were correct. If you said the United States of America, you are also correct. This was an important exercise in equivalencies. While Brexit bolstered the hopes of many who support Texit, the skeptics were quick to make the assertion that the two were too different to compare. The reason for their emphatic declaration was that the European Union and the United States of America were vastly different institutions. Fundamentally, they are wrong. To understand how a modern-day Texit can happen, it is necessary to understand the union to which Texas belongs. This requires addressing some commonly held misconceptions about its nature, its purpose, its founding, and its current status. In the biblical book of Genesis, we're told the story of the Tower of Babel. From the moment small children learn the story in Sunday school, they're taught that it is a cautionary tale about the folly of humans aspiring to godhood. However, as adults and in the context of modern political understanding, I would submit that it teaches us an additional lesson. In the story, when God saw that the people were constructing a tower to heaven, he cursed them in such a way as to prevent their cooperation. He confused their tongues, causing them all to speak different languages. Suddenly, struck with an inability to communicate, the people gave up on construction of the tower and scattered among the earth. When people don't speak the same language, it is impossible to have meaningful discussion and dialogue. We see that in today's political discourse. Although here we speak English, we cannot agree on common definitions. Liberal, a word once reserved for those who wanted to liberate power from the central authority and return it to the people, has come to mean something completely different in today's context. Conservative has become such a watered-down term that even politicians with horrendous voting records on fiscal and social conservatism can claim the mantle of true conservative and do so with a straight face. Marxist and Maoist political philosophy has been repackaged and rebranded as progressivism. Yet if you were to ask 100 different people in the street to define any of these words, you would get a broad set of answers. Expand your question to 300 million people spread across 50 different states, and the variation in answers would make you wonder if you're even speaking the same language. Every day, people say the words United States and America, and never give a second thought to what those words actually mean. If you ask the average person on the street, they have to pause to give it thought, as though they were solving a math problem. Yet people still pledge allegiance to its flag, sing its anthem, and declare their undying loyalty and support for it. That's a success of structured government sponsored schooling right there for you. Continuing. The reason that so many have a challenge with defining these words is that their meaning is not as simple as it may seem on the surface. 230 years ago, the United States of America, with a lowercase u, had a very clear meaning. Its creators understood their creation and all of its legal and philosophical implications. In the intervening years, their clarity has given way to confusion and their concrete vision has been replaced by a superficial affinity to the trappings of that vision. The principles they sought to embody in their lowercase u United States of America have been largely abandoned for a popular love of the pomp and circumstance that alleges to celebrate them. Statements such as these qualify as modern-day heresy and invite the charge of being un-American. Yet those who are quickest to level the charges are generally the same who can't tell you what it means to be an American. Do they mean American in the sense that one lives in America or as a citizen of the United States? Do they mean American in the sense that one adheres to American principles? Do they mean American in the sense that one pledges unquestioning obedience to the federal government? They will likely be ignorant of the fact that those who founded the lowercase u, United States, echoed the same concerns as they feared for what would become of their creation in future generations. In fact, it was George Washington who warned us all to, quote, guard against the impostures of pretended patriotism. Imagine the surprise that those who founded the lowercase u, United States, would have if they saw that many conceptualize the Union as a solitary, monolithic nation-state with its 50 states essentially considered provinces or administrative subdivisions. In the language of their day and in their understanding when they created the Union, the states were the equivalent of modern-day nation-states with all the sovereignty and rights that implies. Therein lies the problem. The difficulty that many have with conceptualizing Texas is that they have a hard time conceptualizing the Union of which Texas is a member. Many are under the delusion that the United States is a nation-state unto itself, and not a collection of nation-states. Even the most vociferous advocates of the single-state ideology struggle to explain away the plain evidence to the contrary. Why is it called the United States of America as opposed to the United State of America? Or, simply, America. Why are there 50 stars on the flag as opposed to one? Why is there still a United States Senate comprised of members who represent their respective states? Why is there an electoral college? Why are states still required to engage one another in matters outside of the purview of the federal government through interstate compacts? Why does each state still have its own constitution with its own laws and its own three branches of government? If the United States of America is a nation state, it has a national government and the states possess no sovereignty. They are merely administrative subdivisions of national government, operating at the pleasure of the federal government with no true identity or voice of their own. This distinction is clearly made in Black's Law Dictionary. A national government is a government of the people of a single state or nation, united as a community by what is termed the social compact, and possessing complete and perfect supremacy over persons and things, so far as they can be made the lawful objects of civil government. A federal government is distinguished from a national government by its being the government of a community of independent and sovereign states, united by compact. If the United States of America is a federative republic, then the states created both the Union and the federal government, and each state still possesses its identity, sovereignty, and rights. The two conditions are mutually exclusive. They both cannot be true. In 2013, then-President Barack Obama gave a speech at the dedication of the George W. Bush Presidential Library. His remarks were fairly unremarkable, except for one word, these. As is tradition, he ended his speech with the words, "God bless these United States." While the slight difference between thee and these went unnoticed by most, the word change and its significance didn't escape the eye of Andrew Burt at The Atlantic. Quote, "The significance lies in the difference between thee and these, between referring to the United States as a singular entity or in the plural, a difference with a long history and one with huge implications. The language we use to talk about ourselves as a country, after all, provides one of the clearest windows into how we see ourselves as a nation and as a people. It was the Articles of Confederation that first gave rise to the United States, and it is the article that precedes United States that tells our story, and ultimately that provides insight into Obama's presidency and the increasing polarization of Americans today. No matter how far removed the policy," end quote, that was, by the way, "no matter how far removed the policies of the Obama administration may have been from the original vision of the Founding Fathers, in this instance, he was right on the money. The Union was referred to in its plural form until it was drummed out of popular usage during the Second World War. There it lay dormant until the 1980s, where it began to re-enter usage under the Reagan presidency. Whether the singular or plural is used in referring to the Union seems like a trivial matter, yet it is key to understanding the Union. In fact, it was Reagan who philosophically and publicly broke with the post-Civil War trend of placing the United States federal government at the apex of power, breaking with the historical revisionists who believed the federal government magically created the states. Reagan declared in his first inaugural address, quote, all of us need to be reminded that the federal government did not create the states. The states created the federal government. Reagan's distinction is as important as Obama's, since both echo the truth about the creation of the Union. From its inception in the Declaration of Independence, the Union was one of independent and sovereign states. Jefferson was clear in drafting the Declaration when he wrote, quote, that these united colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do." End quote. This was acknowledged and understood by Great Britain in the Treaty of Paris that ended the American Revolution and validated the independence of the 13 individual colonies. Quote, "His Britannic Majesty acknowledges that the said United States, viz., New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island and Providence plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, to be free, sovereign, and independent states, that he treats with them as such, and for himself and his heirs and successors, relinquishes all claims to the government, propriety, and territorial rights of the same, in every part thereof." Unquote. These states went on to create a framework under which they would collectively operate, called the Articles of Confederation. In the Articles, the states instituted a process of cooperation in affairs that affected them all, stating, "The said states hereby severally enter into a firm league of friendship with each other, for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them, or any of them, on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or any other pretense whatsoever." When the idealism of the Articles of Confederation met the reality of administering a union of 13 newly independent states, it proved ineffective. Its many shortcomings led directly to the movement to replace the entire document. Ostensibly convening to discuss how to amend the Articles of Confederation, delegates actually exceeded their mandate from their respective states and drafted an entirely new document. The Constitution of the United States was drafted as a remedial document to directly address the shortcomings of the Articles of Confederation. That included the ratification clause as well. Where the Articles of Confederation required the ratification of all 13 states, the Constitution only required ratification by 9 of the 13 to enter into effect. Had only 9 of the states ratified the document, only those 9 states would have lived under the Constitution, and the remaining 4 would have remained under an Articles of Confederation that no longer had enough members to operate. While the Constitution was more effective than the Articles of Confederation at managing a union, The fundamental construction was the same. It was a union of sovereign independent states that created a framework to collectively address common issues. If this sounds remotely familiar, it should. This concept is at the heart of every multilateral treaty ever executed. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was created as a military alliance to provide a common defense for its members, which has now expanded to 29 nations. NATO, which should not exist anymore. But I digress. The United Nations was created as a multinational body to establish a framework for international cooperation on the issues of conflict resolution, human rights, and general welfare. Both are multilateral treaties of which the United States is a signatory. Although there is no definitive number of multilateral treaties of which the United States is a part, some estimates place the number between 200 and 500. Each is an agreement between nation states that establishes an operating framework for one or more aspects of their relationship. In much the same way, the American states created the Union and drafted a constitution as the governing rules for that Union. In that constitution, they created a federal government to administer very specific functions in the document and gave it 30 specific powers with which to accomplish the task. Taken directly from the document, the federal government was given the authority to do the following. Now, as I read through these 30 points, think of some other things the federal government does that aren't included in these 30 points. So, the first one, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Next. To borrow money on the credit of the United States. To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. I think that's the only place it references the federal government handling any kind of immigration, was to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. I could be wrong, but we'll continue to see. Next. To coin money, regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin, and fix a standard of weights and measures. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. To establish post offices and post roads. To promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. To constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. To declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. To raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. How interesting. So no standing armies. Mm-hmm. To provide and maintain a navy. Now they're okay with maintaining a navy. To make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. That's been usurped and out the window. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, and to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. So all the only laws the federal government can do or make are ones that directly fulfill the powers vested in the government by the states. Continuing, no state shall, without the consent of the Congress, lay any imposts or duties or imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. And the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state or on imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States, and all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress. The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. In case of the removal of the President from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the Vice President, and the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the President and Vice President, declaring what officer shall then act as President, and such other officer shall act accordingly, until the disability be removed, or a President shall be elected. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crimes shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed. The Congress shall have power to declare the punishment of treason, but no attainder of treason shall work corruption of blood or forfeiture except during the life of the person attainted. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, and the Congress may, by general laws, prescribe the manner in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved, and the effect thereof. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union. The Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. The Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by Congress. The House of Representatives shall choose their Speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. The times, places, and manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may, at any time, by law, make or alter such regulations, except as to the places of choosing senators. So, because of these specific grants of authority, and to avoid overlap, the Constitution lists very specific actions from which the states are prohibited from engaging. These are specifically listed in Article 1, Section 10, and they are: no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. And the net produce of all duties and imposts laid by any state on imports or exports shall be for the use of the Treasury of the United States, and all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress. And no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops, or ships of war in times of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state, or with a foreign power or engage in war unless actually invaded, or in such prominent imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So that last one, this is me, is what the governor should be using to justify anything he's doing on the border, because the federal government ain't doing anything about it. So continuing with the book, with the final caveat being all states must have a Republican form of government, and all other powers were reserved to the states. Period. To ensure that it would never be forgotten, it was enshrined in the 10th Amendment to the Constitution and cemented as part of the Bill of Rights. Quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. In arguing for the inclusion of language to the Constitution that would explicitly reserve sovereignty to the states, Fisher Ames in the Ratification Convention of Massachusetts said, quote, a consolidation of the states would subvert the new Constitution, and against which this article is our best security. Too much provision cannot be made against consolidation. The state governments represent the wishes and feelings and local interests of the people. They are the safeguard and ornament of the Constitution. They will protract the period of our liberties. They will afford a shelter against the abuse of power and will be the natural avengers of our violated rights. Unquote. So this just goes to what I've been saying a long time forever, and especially on this podcast, that this is our chance. This is Texas's chance to break free and not be dragged down with the sinking ship of the federal government in Mordor, D.C. The state government is the last bastion of defense against the tyranny coming out of Washington. And Fisher Ames stated it right there why that was the case. So I'll continue here. Neither the current operations of the federal government, past legal decisions of the Supreme Court, historical revisionism, nor commonly held fallacies change the fundamental structure of the Union as a voluntary political and economic union comprised of independent sovereign states, each containing a separate and distinct people. Even Alexander Hamilton, who dreamed of a single nation with the states merely functioning as corporations, conceded the distinct and sovereign existence of the states in Federalist No. 32. Quote, an entire consolidation of the states into one complete national sovereignty would imply an entire subordination of the parts, and whatever powers might remain in them would be altogether dependent on the general will. But the plan of the convention aims only at a partial union or consolidation. The state governments would clearly retain all rights of sovereignty which they had before had and which were not, by that act, exclusively delegated to the United States. Unquote. We need only look to the words of James Madison, the father of the Constitution and the fourth president of the United States, for confirmation. Quote, each state, in ratifying the Constitution, is considered as a sovereign body, independent of all others, and only to be bound by its own voluntary act. In this relation, then, the new Constitution will, if established, be a federal and not a national constitution. He and the other founding fathers understood what being a state meant in the context of the United States. While the language has evolved, the meaning of the term in their day is still important. States of the United States are called states for a reason. They were not, and still are not, called provinces, territories, divisions, or regions. In fact, referring back to the Declaration of Independence, we see Jefferson refer to Great Britain as the State of Great Britain, making it clear that individual states of the Union are each equal in all respects to Great Britain. Texans who colonized the then Mexican state carried this concept with them. Stephen F. Austin, writing in 1836, elaborated on this concept of statehood when citing the sources of the conflict between Texas and the Mexican government. Quote, when the federal system and constitution were adopted in 1824, and the former provinces became states, Texas, by her representative in the Constituent Congress, exercised the right which was claimed and exercised by all the provinces of retaining within her own control the rights and powers which appertained to her as one of the unities or distinct societies, which confederated together to form the Federal Republic of Mexico. But not possessing at that time sufficient population to become a state by herself, She was, with her own consent, united provincially with Kohalua. Kohia. A neighboring province or society to form the state of Coahuila. I can't believe I've never actually said that. And Texas. Y Tejas. Until Texas possessed the necessary elements to form a separate state herself. I don't know why that is a tongue twister to me. He continues. I quote the words of the Constitutional or Organic Act passed by the Constituent Congress of Mexico on the 7th of May, 1824, which establishes the state of Coahuila y Tejas, and Texas. This law and principles on which the Mexican Federal Compact was formed gave Texas a specific political existence, invested in her inhabitants the special and well-defined rights of self-government as a state of the Mexican Confederation. So soon as she possessed the necessary elements, Texas consented to the provisional union with Coahuila on the faith of this guarantee. It was therefore a solemn compact, which neither the state of Coahuila and Texas nor the general government of Mexico can change without the consent of the people of Texas. Coahuila. Okay. Continuing here, the Mexican government's failure to abide by its agreement with the people of Texas and to recognize their specific political existence as a state led directly to the Texas Revolution and Texas declaring its independence. It is this meaning of state that Texans understood when they made a conscious choice to join the Union. Texans understood that their state would continue to be a sovereign political entity when it entered into the Union, just like all of the other states who were currently in the Union. This was a guarantee given in the joint resolution of annexation when the United States Congress declared that Texas was admitted into the Union by virtue of this act on an equal footing with the existing states. However, the post-war Texas Constitution shatters this idea in its very first lines. Article 1, Section 1 of the Texas Constitution of 1876 declares, Texas is a free and independent state, subject only to the Constitution of the United States and the maintenance of our free institutions and the perpetuity of the Union depend upon the preservation of the right of local self-government unimpaired to all the states. Unquote. Texas is a free, independent, and sovereign state in a political and economic union with 49 other free, independent, and sovereign states. Collectively, these states work together to common ends and to solve common challenges. They operate under a framework that is codified in the Constitution of the United States. This framework created a federal government whose job it is to administer the Union in very specific ways. Anything beyond that, the states are, in every respect, like any other sovereign nation state elsewhere anywhere in the world. We are not, nor were we ever intended to be, one nation. Madison clearly articulated this fact in the rationale behind labeling it as fallacy. Quote, first, in order to ascertain the real character of the government, it may be considered in relation to the foundation on which it is to be established, to the sources from which its ordinary powers are to be drawn, to the operation of those powers, to the extent of them, and to the authority by which future changes in the government are to be introduced. On examining the first relation, it appears on one hand that the Constitution is to be found on the assent and ratification of the people of America, given by deputies elected for the special purpose, but on the other, that this assent and ratification is to be given by the people, not as individuals composing one entire nation, but as composing the distinct and independent states to which they respectively belong. It is to be the assent and ratification of the several states derived from the supreme authority in each state, the authority of the people themselves. The act, therefore, establishing the Constitution will not be a national but a federal act, that it will be a federal and not national act, as these terms are understood by the objectors. The act of the people, as forming so many independent states, not as forming one aggregate nation, is obvious from the single consideration, that it is to result neither from the decision of a majority of the people of the Union, nor from that of a majority of the states. It must result from the unanimous assent of the several states that are parties to it. Differing no other know otherwise from their ordinary assent than in its being expressed, not by the legislative authority, but by that of the people themselves. Were the people regarded in this transaction as forming one nation, the will of the majority of the whole people of the United States would bind the minority, in the same manner as the majority in each state must bind the minority, or the majority in each state must bind the minority. And the will of the majority must be determined either by a comparison of the individual votes or by considering the will of the majority of the states as evidence of the will of a majority of the people of the United States. Neither of these rules have been adopted. Each state, in ratifying the Constitution, is considered as a sovereign body, independent of all others, and only to be bound by its own voluntary act. In this relation, then, the new Constitution will, if established, be a federal and not a national constitution. Unquote. The idea of an American nation was a fringe idea at best until the Civil War. After the Civil War, misnamed Civil War, War of Northern Aggression, War to Prevent Southern Independence, whatever, what have you, I continue, it became trending to promote the idea of an American nation in an attempt to heal the wounds caused by war and to retroactively justify the prosecution of the war. However, no single person contributed more to this idea than a late 19th century Christian socialist who had been removed from the pulpit as a Baptist minister for delivering sermons on topics such as Jesus the Socialist. That failed minister was Francis Bellamy. Bellamy was not nearly as well known at the time as his cousin, Edward Bellamy, who had the second best-selling book of the 1800s, Looking Backward. The book envisions a future United States where everyone has equal incomes, and at the age of 21, men are conscripted into an industrial army, working in jobs assigned to them by the federal government. Bellamy's book was an inspiration to many who, in the spirit of his work, began to found nationalist clubs, promoting Bellamy's ideas and advocating for a government takeover of the economy. Francis would found a nationalist club of his own in Boston. Shortly after the founding of the Nationalist Club in Boston, Francis looked for a way to promote Edward's vision to the youth of the day. Francis Bellamy penned these words for Youth's Companion, a popular children's magazine. I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. With the help of the magazine and the National Education Association, Bellamy was able to promote the pledge to public schools throughout the United States with these explicit instructions as to how it was to be given. Quote, at a signal from the principal, the pupils in ordered ranks, hands to their side, face the flag. Another signal is given. Every pupil gives the flag the military salute, right hand lifted, palm downward, to align with the forehead and close to it, at the words, to my flag. The right hand is raised. The right hand is extended gracefully, palm upwards, towards the flag, and remains in this gesture until the end of the affirmation, whereupon all hands immediately drop to the side. Bellamy's pledge became widely popular. In 1923, words were added to specify the flag of the United States. However, in the 1930s, another change was instituted as some began to notice similarities between Bellamy's salute and another salute that had become quite popular in Europe, the fascist salute. In fact, the pledge, the ceremony, and the ideals Bellamy sought to promote with it are well known to us today as fascism. The nationalization of industries and the incorporation of workers into a massive labor army were major programs of the German National Socialists, Mussolini's Italian Fascists, and Roosevelt's New Deal. Without a doubt, Bellamy's vision of a radical nationalist state with a socialist economic system has more in common with Hitler and FDR than with Washington, Madison, and Jefferson's vision of the United States. Yet his greatest tool for promotion of this ideology is recited daily by schoolchildren throughout the United States to this very day. That's why I will never say the pledge anymore. Once I understood that a long time ago, nope, not anymore. Not just that, but also read the actual words. Pledging allegiance to a flag? Yeah, I don't know. Continuing, as a tool of indoctrination into the cult of the one nation doctrine, which it's not, and it says that in there, so that's wrong in the first place, it has been extremely effective. It is not uncommon to hear a well-meaning opponent of Texas recite the Pledge of Allegiance as though it were law, followed by an imaginary mic drop like they uttered something truly profound. But it is not the law, nor does it inform the actual conversation about the existence of an American nation, one iota. The fact is, there is no American people. There are people who live on the North American continent, but that also includes Canadians and Mexicans. There are people who live within the political union called the United States of America. Perhaps those are the Americans, but to say that America is one nation, a single homogeneous and well-defined people, is a massive stretch. If we are one people, then it seems unusual that we would all readily identify ourselves as something other than simply American. While American is a handy term, much like European or Asian, it ignores the fact that those who most would call American more regularly identify themselves as and others as something other than American. People in Texas clearly identify themselves as Texans. People in South Louisiana are quick to identify themselves as Cajuns. People across the southern states clearly identify themselves as Southerners, just as folks in the Midwest identify themselves as Midwesterners. Californians are some of the quickest to let a person know they identify with their home state. The divisions are more pronounced than it would initially seem. They are not isolated to geography. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, Bloomberg Businessweek published a series of articles called One Nation Divisible. In an attempt to see just how divided Americans are, they separated the most common terms for self-identification and then extrapolated the total number of possible combinations. Their results were insightful. Quote, "We categorized Americans using these five divisions. Red state or blue state, young or old, rich or not rich, white or minority, male or female, and arranged these groups into every possible combination. Old men, red state, young women, old rich, minority men, blue state, young rich, white women, etc. And you wind up with 242 different Americas. More and more, these differences are becoming hard to ignore, whether it's in politics, policy, or principles. The idea that America is one people and one nation is an increasingly harder sell. When Travis wrote his famous letter from the Alamo, he called for aid in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character. If he wrote that same letter today, it's not entirely clear what he would get when appealing to the American character. Herein lies the fundamental challenge with understanding the American Union, especially in the context of Texas. The lack of clarity in language creates a moving target, stifles legitimate debate on the relationship of the states within the Union, and serves to conceal the damage done by the federal government to the rights of the states and of the people. When one talks about America, the question arises as to which America we're talking about. There is America the landmass, with its amber waves of grain. There are the ideals of freedom, liberty, and representative government that we typically classify as American. Then there is the United States of America, the political and economic union embodied in the federal government. Although these are separate and distinct viewpoints, the tendency is to repeat them all as one and the same. The effect is chilling. If you criticize the political and economic union or the actions of the federal government, you're branded as un-American, as though by daring to question the effectiveness or actions of the government, you're somehow the moral equivalent of the Islamic State trying to destroy the ideals upon which the Union was originally founded. Even when the actions of the Union are contrary and diametrically opposed to the generally recognized American principles upon which the Union was founded, criticism to the point of advocating exiting the Union invites the slur and hurling of the pejorative secessionist. Proud to be one. Or you can just call me Secesh. Continuing. Prior to the widespread use of the term Texit, anything related to Texas independence was classified using the word secession. However, Texit and secession are not entirely synonymous, and it is an important distinction. It depends on how you define the actual relationship between the states of the United States. If you believe the United States of America is a monolithic nation state, and the states are merely administrative subdivisions of the federal government, then secession is your term. However, if you believe the United States of America is a federated republic of sovereign independent states who delegated specific, limited powers to a federal government, and any other powers reside with the states, then Texit is your term. Okay. In her September 2000 paper, Who, Why, and How, Assessing the Legitimacy of Secession, Dr. Josette Baer, professor of political theory at the University of Zurich in Switzerland, highlighted the nuanced difference and its impact on any legitimate discussions on the issue. Quote, "For the sake of clearly limited terms, let me shortly explain why I do not consider secession as appropriate a term when dealing with supernatural political buildings like the European Union or the Commonwealth of Independent States. One could argue that the decision to leave such a structure represents indeed a secession, since it zeals at the regaining of the amount of sovereignty once ceded by virtue of the membership treaties agreed upon. However, the crucial thing in this matter has to do with the nature of these structures and the amount of sovereignty. The amount of sovereignty ceded to a supranational building differs quantitatively from sovereignty established by a state building. It also differs qualitatively because the decision to enter the Union has been met by sovereign states which express their consent by committing themselves to agreements whose details and conditions they were able to negotiate. For the leave of a supranational building, I therefore suggest to speak of cancellation of membership rather than of secession." Interesting. That's unquote. Very interesting. I'm going to noodle on that. Secession versus Texit. This distinction makes Texit more like the UK's exit from the European Union. In the 21st century, and especially in its application to what's taking place in Texas, this is an important distinction to make. If Texit is secession from a monolithic nation state, then it renders the Founding Fathers' original intent for the Union irrelevant and cedes any sovereignty retained by Texas upon its original entry into the Union completely and totally to the federal government. If Texit is a withdrawal of membership from a political and economic union that has overstepped its bounds, we are able to claim the original sovereignty of the state and set the stage for the battle over Texit as an acceptance or rejection by the federal government of the original intent of the union. In short, someone's attitude towards Texit is often directly tied to his or her understanding of the American Union. If one understands that it is based on a fundamental ignorance of the original purpose of the Union, then they will likely oppose any discussion of Texit at a visceral level. If, however, one understands the true origins and purpose of the United States, then they can clearly see how vastly today America's Union has strayed from its original course, and then Texit becomes a discussion that must be had, not only for Texas, but for every state in the United States. That's the end of that chapter. Very interesting distinction there. Took us a long time to get to that point, but I never really thought about it that way. And I think he makes an amazing case towards the importance of which word we use when we're discussing this stuff. This podcast, Leave the Swamp, I call it the Texit Podcast. And I say, join the cause for a peaceful and friendly separation. Perhaps it shouldn't be a separation, because that implies it's not totally severed. If you're thinking back to like a marriage or something, right? You're separated, but you're not divorced. I think I might change that to a peaceful and friendly divorce, so that it comes across as more final. Very interesting. I'm going to noodle on that. But it makes sense. If secession means you're leaving a geographical area is asserting or creating its new sovereignty, then, technically that wouldn't be what Texas would be doing if it left the United States. It would just be taking back that amount of sovereignty that it handed over to, or that it loaned its agent in Washington, in Mordor, and it's saying, we're firing you as our agent because you failed in your duties. So we're leaving. We're exiting. We're leaving the swamp. It makes total sense. Very interesting. I'll have to... I got to re-kind of train my mind on using the word Texit all the time, I guess, now. And try to stop using the word secede or secession. We'll see. Very interesting. All right. Well, you learn new things every day. That's why it's fun to read stuff like this and go through it as I go. I'm honored to be doing it and going through it with you. So thank you for listening to the Texit podcast and doing your part to join the cause for a peaceful and friendly divorce. All right. There it is. So, all right, with that, I hope you come back and stick with us. I hope you're talking to folks about it. I hope you're mentioning Texit to folks. We got to do it, or we'll be dragged down to the abyss with the Eye of Sauron in DC. So we have the chance, but it's fleeting, to take back our history, take back our future, to take back control of our fate, and that's through Texit. So join me, spread the word, spread the good word, and we'll keep grinding. All right. With that, have a good one.